Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
The conventional wisdom regarding this week's Torah reading and its placement in the Joseph cycle is as follows. Having been thrown into the pit by his brothers, sold into slavery, subsequently falsely accused and imprisoned, Joseph, by way of his gift for dream interpretation, knack for self-promotion, and God-given boyish good looks, rises to a position of prominence in Egyptian society, second only to Pharaoh himself. Years later, in a time of famine, Joseph's brothers, except for Benjamin, journey to Egypt for provisions and find themselves standing before their brother, whose true identity, hidden behind his Egyptian dress, tongue, and demeanor, remains secret. Reminded of his brother's misdeeds, Joseph sets into motion an elaborate plan, part vengeance, part test, to ascertain whether they have changed in the intervening years. Joseph accuses them of being spies and imprisons one brother, Simeon, sending the others back home to Canaan with the stipulation that Simeon's release is contingent on the appearance of Benjamin, Joseph's younger and full brother, their shared mother being Rachel. Upon returning to Canaan, their father Jacob refuses to let Benjamin go, reasoning that both Joseph and Simeon are no more, and he's not about to lose another son. Time passes, the famine worsens, Judah vows that should anything happen to Benjamin, it will be on him. And eventually, reluctantly, Jacob's hand is forced to let all the brothers, Benjamin included, return to Egypt. The brothers return to Joseph, dine together, and Joseph sends them on their way with their provisions. The denouement occurs as Joseph has a goblet secretly placed in Benjamin's bags and then sends his guards in pursuit. Benjamin is caught red-handed, and Joseph announces that he, Benjamin, will remain a slave for his crime. Our Torah reading this week begins with Judah approaching Joseph, stepping up to the moral plate and delivering a heartrending speech, which, amongst other things, offers himself up in the place of Benjamin. It's at this point that Joseph realizes that his brothers have learned their lesson, are willing to put their fraternal obligations and themselves before self-interest. Having demonstrated their contrition, they have passed the test, and Joseph bursts out weeping, announcing, "I am Joseph. Is my father alive?" Joseph kisses all his brothers. Benjamin and Joseph embrace. They are sent to retrieve their father Jacob, and while missing out on a few key elements, they live happily ever after. This is a story about repentance, about forgiveness, and about reconciliation. A story for the ages, worthy of a four-part novel, and some might even say a Broadway play. This morning, I want to invite you in to my lifetime obsession with the Joseph story and offer the beginnings of an alternate and, to the best of my knowledge, original read of the text, which, while not undermining the aforementioned conventional read, sheds new light on our age-old story and helps explain some of the more curious elements of my favorite biblical narrative. I want to posit that a full appreciation of today's Torah reading demands that one reach back not just to the moment when Joseph was thrown into the pit, but even further back to an often overlooked exchange involving Joseph and Benjamin's mother, Rachel. A few weeks ago in Parshat Vayetzeh, we read of how Jacob labored all those years in the house of Rachel's father, Laban the Aramean, fathering many children by several women until the arrival of Joseph, by the way of his beloved Rachel. Together with his wives, children, and property, Jacob would eventually flee the house of Laban. Having pursued Jacob and his family, Laban caught up, accusing Jacob not only of stealing his daughters and family, but also his household gods. Jacob insisted that he had done no such thing, so indignant at the accusation that he proclaimed rashly, as it turned out, that anyone with whom the idols shall be found shall not live in the presence of our brothers. Little did Jacob know that Rachel had indeed taken the idols, proof positive of the adage that you can take the girl out of a house of idolaters, but you can't take the idolatry out of the girl. Laban searched Jacob's household, but Rachel had hidden the idols, and her father-in-law soon went on his way. The tragic coda to the story, however, was that Jacob's curse would prove prophetic. Rachel did die soon thereafter as she gave birth to Benjamin. For those with an appreciation of the Bible's structural poetics, Jacob and his family's flight from Laban's house is significant both unto itself as a proleptic foreshadowing of the national narrative to come, the Israelites who fled their Egyptian oppressors, but not without taking a bit of idolatry with them, an interbiblical allusion made explicit in the Passover Haggadah. But one need not jump all the way to the Exodus narrative to appreciate the reverberations of the Rachel-Benjamin story. Indeed, one need not be a literary theorist of note to see the parallels between this earlier narrative and the narrative of this week's Torah reading. The children of Jacob are on the move, and they are pursued by their former host. There's an accusation of stolen goods, and in response, a declaration that whosoever is found to be in possession of said objects, that person shall be punished. The parallels in literary structure, thematics, and even word choice are striking. And lest you think that this is too much of a stretch, I'm not the only one to have made this connection. A very long time ago, for very different purposes, the authors of a rabbinic compilation of Midrash called the Tanhuma pointed out the connection between Benjamin's cup and Rachel's stolen idols, like mother, like son. The key difference, of course, being that Benjamin got caught and lived, while Rachel did not and died. All of which is very interesting. An interbiblical rhyme no different than countless other moments of intertextuality, a subject which I spent many years in graduate school exploring. But none of which answers the all-important question of so what? So what if this week's scene is an intergenerational, intertextual allusion to an earlier scene? So what if Joseph hiding his cup in Benjamin's sack appears to reference their late mother's deeds? Aside from being a wink to the reader that certain biblical tropes recur in the Bible, does the identification of this recurring theme impact our understanding of the story? My answer, not surprisingly, is absolutely. Whether the brothers did or did not know about Rachel's theft, Jacob's vow, Benjamin's birth, and Rachel's passing in that birth is something that the Bible never makes explicit. What we do know is that all of Jacob's children were present at that moment and most likely witnessed to it all. And we can safely presume that a family story like that doesn't stay hidden forever. Not from the brothers who were alive, nor from Benjamin, who was born soon thereafter. No different than in our own families, when two siblings, no matter how grown up they are, forever share a storehouse of childhood experiences, it seems altogether plausible that the children of Jacob were well aware not only of their flight from Laban's house, but also Benjamin's late mother's theft and near discovery. All of which to say is that the audience of this interbiblical allusion is not just the reader, but the brothers themselves. To put it plainly, I think that when Joseph hid the cup in Benjamin's bag, pursued the brothers and announced Benjamin's fate, he did so not just to test their fraternal bonds or check on their level of contrition. Joseph was making an all but explicit inner family reference in order to drop a not so hot subtle hint that only they would understand, hoping that they too would remember and see the connection. Why play games? Why not just reveal himself as Joseph without all the cat and mouse tactics? Nobody knows for sure, but it seems to me that for whatever reason, Joseph had decided not to reveal his identity all at once. He took small steps, inch by inch, gaining confidence in himself and his brothers. When the brothers feasted together, Joseph, identity still secret, sat his brothers in precise age order, much to the brothers' astonishment and no doubt arousing their suspicions. It was to Benjamin, his only brother, his only full brother, who would receive a portion exponentially larger than the others. Joseph was many things, but clumsy he wasn't. I think Joseph wanted his brothers to know that he knew who they were, but was understandably doing so hesitatingly. He also incidentally needed a way to test his brothers while keeping his brother Benjamin safe from threat. I think Joseph was giving Benjamin first and foremost a nod as to what was going on. The goblet in Benjamin's sack was a final cue, their cue for the breakthrough to undo the damage that had been done so many years ago. And Judah, I believe, as he spoke to Joseph, knew. He knew that this Egyptian before him was a Jew. The clues were laid out in front of him, and he had learned along the way by way of his daughter-in-law Tamar, a story that we don't have time to get into right now, but that sometimes he learned there's more to the person in front of you than meets the eye. I think Judah knew because his speech all but says that Judah knew who Joseph was. Take a moment to read it this morning. The focal point of Judah's remarks is not what you would expect, a defense of Benjamin or maybe a plea for lighter sentencing. Judah's speech pounded away again and again at the one thing that could break Joseph's veneer, and by extension, the stalemate, the one thing that the two brothers shared in common that could turn the screws and pull at the heartstrings, and that was their father, Jacob. No less than 14 times, Jacob is referenced in Judah's speech. All that is missing is Cat Stevens' father and son in the background. Furthermore, if nothing else, Judah's speech clarifies for the first time that Jacob was not in any way complicit in Joseph's descent to Egypt, a clarification that resolves one of the great conundrums of the entire story, namely why in all of the years since Joseph was released from prison did he not communicate to his father by person, by messenger, phone, email, or text that he was alive. Judah knew that the Egyptian enthroned before him was Joseph, and he knew that somewhere deep inside, Joseph wanted Judah to know. Judah's speech was not a plea for mercy nor a declaration of remorse. Its rhetorical brilliance is that he pried Joseph out of his Egyptian and emotional shell. It explains why a broken and weeping Joseph's first Hebrew words to his brothers were, "Ani Yosef, ha'od avi chai," I am Joseph, is my father still living? At first blush, Joseph's response is nonsensical in that Judah has just spent the last 16 verses speaking of his clearly living father and the consequences that would befall Jacob should Benjamin be detained. But knowing now what we know, or at least what I'm suggesting, it is clear that Joseph's sputtering question, "Shall my father live?" was directed not at the brothers, but at himself, an interrogative signaling that Joseph understood that his father's well-being was contingent on whether he would bring this kabuki dance with his brothers to a conclusion. It is a lot. There are still a few I's to dots and T's to cross, some loose ends yet to be resolved. But basically, my argument is that by the time of Judah's speech before Joseph, Judah strongly suspected to whom he was speaking because Joseph had strongly hinted at who he was. Joseph was ready, even if he did not fully realize it, to reconcile a fact that Judah suspected and was prepared to seize upon. As Joseph caught his breath, he tells his brothers that it's time to let bygones be bygones. The past is the past. There's a shared future to be had, and it's the job of the living to embrace tikkun, amending within the family, and make the most of the present. The language of Joseph and Benjamin's tearful embrace mirrors the language of other biblical fraternal embraces, a signal to the reader that the underlying message of this story is not just the importance of these particular brothers, but the importance of all sibling bonds, not to get mired in the wrongs of yesteryear, a past that more often than not dates back way, way back, further than anyone really remembers. It is a message, incidentally, that receives a punctuation point by way of this morning's Haftorah reading, which Rabbi Zuckerman mentioned, in what I believe to be one of the most beautiful images of all of biblical literature, the prophet Ezekiel grasping two sticks. Upon one is inscribed Judah, and the other, Joseph, a prophetic vision of redemption whereby two siblings are both brought together in one hand as one family. Friends, sometimes a cup is just a cup. And sometimes that cup, it signals a whole lot more than meets the eye. You can read the story of Joseph and Judah for the story that it is, but you can also probe it in all its layered and technicolor possibilities, which, no different than our own family stories, can be understood if we are willing to do the hard work to plumb the past, but not let that past be an obstacle to our future. We are, after all cupbearers sitting in prisons of one sort or another. We are all sitting around waiting for the other to make the first move. The key to our freedom and the freedom of others is whether we will choose to use the gift of memory to unlock the future, which is ours to enjoy. Those cups and goblets are, after all, never quite as hidden as we say they are. They are there for anyone willing to take the time to find them. And you know what? If we do, if we find those cups, we might just discover that those cups, they can overflow. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, the place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul.